2 Samuel 9 through 10, the fifth talk in a series in 2 Samuel, was presented by David Crabtree on March 8, 2009 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2009. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We'll be looking at 2 Samuel, chapters 9 and 10. Before we start in on chapter 9, I got two or three emails over the course of the week asking various questions about last Sunday. And I thought that I'd just talk a little bit about one of the questions that was raised. Last Sunday, I talked about the blessing that was given to David and the prophecy that his seed, his descendant, would come and he would build a house for God and his kingdom would be established forever. And that the relationship between this descendant of David and God would be the relationship of a father and a son. And the question was asked, what is being predicted here? And that is to say, first of all, what could people at that time have understood? And what was intended by God, in the full intent of that prediction or that prophecy? What's being claimed here is that the relationship between this descendant of David and God would be a father-son relationship. So there's the father-son relationship is being used as an analogy, as a way, something that is familiar to us, that is being likened to something that is unfamiliar to us in order that we can understand better what that unfamiliar thing is. And that unfamiliar thing is the relationship between the descendant of David and God himself. And that's the way analogies work in general. The tricky thing about analogies is knowing when does the analogy carry over, when does it have an analog, and when do those analogs stop? So what analogs are being are intended? In this particular analogy, the things that jump out at one, I think, when you think of a father-son relationship, is there are three things, I think, that jump out immediately. One is that it's a relationship that is uniquely close, that there are shared interests between father and son. The second is that it's hierarchical, that in the father-son relationship, it is not a relationship of peers. It's a relationship of one with greater authority over one with lesser authority. And the third is that it's enduring or permanent. The relationship between a father and son is one that can't be severed. We don't even have a legal process for doing so. And I think all these three elements that come to mind when you think about a father-son relationship are intended in what was said to David, because it points out, I'll go down the three, uniquely close, that they have common interests. It says that the son will build a house for the father, and the father will place the son on the throne forever. So there's this identity between them, common interests that they're shared. Hierarchical, it talks about the father disciplining the son in the prophecy that's made. And the third, that it's permanent or enduring, it says explicitly that God will not reject this descendant of David like he did Saul. So it's a permanent relationship. So I think all of those three elements that come to mind when you think about a father-son relationship, that those are all intended and they are all reinforced in the prophecy itself. But if we're to ask the question, how would people at the time have responded to this, if they had heard this, how would David have responded to it? How would others at the time of David have responded to this? I don't think that this would have been... I think clearly David saw this as an enormous blessing. This was a great promise that was being made to him, that his descendant would establish a kingdom that would last forever, and that this descendant would have a unique relationship with God himself. That's a great blessing. But it wouldn't have sounded strange, I don't think. It was commonplace in the ancient cultures, in Egypt as well as Mesopotamia, for them to think in terms of their kings being the son of God, their kings having some kind of special relationship with their God. So this would not have sounded entirely strange, I think, to the Israelites. And they probably assumed that it would be that same kind of relationship between this descendant of David and Yahweh. What did God intend by this analogy? Well, I think what God intended was what came to pass. That all of that, all of what the relationship between Jesus and God was actually there in that prophecy that God made initially. And I think that it includes the fact that Jesus was born of a virgin, that Jesus' birth was brought about by the activity of the Holy Spirit. I was thinking about this a little bit over the week while I was cutting blackberries. The virgin birth is a strange thing. I was thinking, if you were to take Jesus' DNA and test it, what would the chromosomes show? And when I start thinking about down those lines, I think this is so weird that I don't even know what to do with it. It is so contrary to my common sense. It just gets strange. I believe that Jesus was born of a virgin because the Bible says that that is the case, and I have become convinced that the Bible is a reliable source of information, not because it appeals to my common sense. But in any case, I think this was probably in view when the prediction was made, that even this was part of what God intended when he spoke to David. But I do find it interesting that the New Testament doesn't talk more about the virgin birth. That is not a big topic. It shows up in two of the Gospels, and then one can kind of read it into some other places. But as far as I know, those are the only two places where it's really made explicit. What's interesting to me is that the emphasis in the New Testament is on Jesus' sentness. He's the one. He is the one that God said is going to come. He is the fulfillment of all those prophecies of the Messiah that was to come. He was the son of David that God was talking about in 2 Samuel chapter 7. And that anyone who knows the Father will recognize the Son because he's a chip off the old block. That if you know God, you can spot this one that is uniquely representative of God. And that's what was so remarkable about Jesus. He came in a form that people didn't expect, but those who really knew God could recognize him nevertheless. And the titles that are common throughout the Gospels, the Son of Man, the Son of God, those are all titles that signify this one that's going to represent God. And that's really the most distinctive thing about Jesus is he is the one that God said he would send. Okay, let's look at 2 Samuel 9, first 8 verses. Then David said, "Is there yet anyone left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake?" Now there was a servant in the house of Saul whose name was Ziba, and they called him to David. And the king said to him, "Are you Ziba?" And he said, "I am your servant." And the king said, "Is there not yet anyone of the house of Saul to whom I may show the kindness of God?" And Ziba said to the king, "There is still a son of Jonathan who is crippled in both feet." So the king said to him, "Where is he?" And Ziba said to the king, "Behold, he is in the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, in Lodabar." Then King David sent and brought him from the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, from Lodabar. And Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, came to David and fell on his face and prostrated himself. And David said, "Mephibosheth." And he said, "Here is your servant." And David said to him, "Do not fear, for I will surely show kindness to you for the sake of your father Jonathan, and will restore to you all the land of your grandfather Saul, and you shall eat at my table regularly." Again he prostrated himself and said, "What is your servant that you should regard a dead dog like me?" So David has become firmly established as king over all of Israel. Things are going well. The kingdom has been expanded much beyond the boundaries that it had been during the time of Saul. He has defeated the enemies that have for decades, if not centuries, have plagued the Israelites. So now things he is kind of resting from what he has been doing, and he reflects back on the promise that he had made to Jonathan, that they had made a covenant, and David had promised that he would be loyal to Jonathan and his descendants all of his life. David is remembering back to that oath that he had taken, and now he wants to make good on it. It's interesting, the descendants of Saul apparently have disappeared. They're in hiding or they've died, but David doesn't know if there are any around. And he asked for descendants of Saul. The promise that he had made was with respect to the descendants of Jonathan particularly. So David asks around, and the only way that anyone he knows of determining whether there are any descendants of Saul is to check in with Ziba, who had been in charge of all of Saul's household when Saul was king. So they locate this former servant of Saul, Ziba, and they call him into the palace, and David asks him, "Are there any descendants of Saul left?" Because, and he tells him why, it's not to kill them, which might be expected, but rather it is to show kindness to them. And Ziba only indicates that there is one descendant left that happens to be the grandson of Saul, the son of Jonathan. That's Mephibosheth. Now, if you recall, a few chapters back, it mentioned Mephibosheth for the first time. Apparently, on the day when the battle took place in which Saul and Jonathan were killed, when news of that defeat and the death of Saul and Jonathan reached the palace, there must have been panic. Because what it says is that a servant, a nurse of Mephibosheth, picked him up and was running out of the household, and she fell, and Mephibosheth was hurt. Both of his legs were damaged. I don't know if they were broken or exactly what happened, but they were damaged. And As he grew up, he was crippled in both feet as a result of that incident. And we were told about that a couple chapters earlier. Well, now Ziba is saying Mephibosheth is the descendant that remains, the son of Jonathan, and he is staying with Machir. Machir is a character that we will see one more time later in the narrative. He's apparently a wealthy man, apparently a Benjamite. He's living in Benjamite territory. And he has apparently taken in Mephibosheth and is taking care, making sure that Mephibosheth is taken care of. So David sends to this man, Machir, sends word to Mephibosheth to come and appear before David. Mephibosheth comes. Mephibosheth is probably scared to death because he is entirely at David's mercy. And it would have been customary, it would have been prudent for David to kill all of the descendants of Saul, because it would be a descendant of Saul who would be best positioned to stage some kind of coup. But Mephibosheth comes, and he bows down before David, and he says, "Here is your servant." Clearly, he sees himself at David's mercy, but he's trusting that David will look kindly on him. And David responds immediately by saying, "Do not fear." He obviously senses Mephibosheth's concern and alleviates that immediately, and says that he is going to show kindness to him for the sake of Jonathan. He says, "I will restore to you all the land of your grandfather Saul, and you shall eat at my table regularly." So two parts to it. One is all the lands will be restored. Apparently, when Saul died and his descendant, the others in his family, died, it would appear that the lands were taken away from the heirs of Saul. It's not clear whether David did that, or whether it was governmental action, or whether it was local squatters, or exactly what happened. It's not clear. But that land apparently was taken away from Saul's descendants. And David is saying he's going to give that back. That's where it belongs. It'll go back to them. The second thing is, "You shall eat regularly at my table." If you'll recall, when David was initially looked kindly upon by Saul and was made Saul's armor bearer, Saul gave David a place at his table. So David enjoyed this kind of status. Now David is going to extend this same status to Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth responds with incredulity. He's thankful and incredulous that this is happening. He says, "What is your servant that you should regard a dead dog like me?" Dead dogs apparently are fairly low on the social scale. Next section. "Then the king called Saul's servant Ziba and said to him, 'All that belonged to Saul and to all his house I have given to your master's grandson. And you and your sons and your servants shall cultivate the land for him. And you shall bring in the produce so that your master's grandson may have food. Nevertheless, Mephibosheth, your master's grandson, shall eat at my table regularly.' Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. Then Ziba said to the king, 'According to all that my lord the king commands his servant, so your servant will do.' So Mephibosheth ate at David's table as one of the king's sons. And Mephibosheth had a young son whose name was Micah. And all who lived in the house of Ziba were servants to Mephibosheth. So Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem, for he ate at the king's table regularly. Now he was lame in both feet." So David calls in Ziba And he tells Ziba, here's the arrangement. All of the lands that had been belonged to Saul are going to be returned. They're going to be turned over to Mephibosheth. He will be the owner, and you will be in charge of it. You and your sons and your servants. And he has a lot of sons. He has 15 sons and 20 servants. So they are going to run this estate. They're going to farm it and do all that's necessary to keep it productive and keep it going. And that will be for the benefit of Mephibosheth. But in addition to that, Mephibosheth is going to eat at the table, as David had mentioned earlier. So Mephibosheth enjoys the status of a son of David, that he enjoys the same status as David's son, sitting at the table. The lands of Saul would have been located about 3 miles north of Jerusalem, so his estate isn't very far away, but Mephibosheth apparently was given residence in Jerusalem. He stays in Jerusalem. Presumably that's provided by David as well. It's interesting that this whole section ends with the sentence, now he was lame in both feet, stressing the fact that here is someone who will have difficulty taking care of himself, and David has taken that upon himself. But it's also kind of interesting to remember that when Jerusalem was taken, the Jebusites had said the blind and the lame could protect themselves in this city. And David, when he took Jerusalem, he was going to drive out those who were hated, the lame, the blind, and the lame. Well, here we have a case in which this particular lame person is being brought back into Jerusalem, not because of anything that he deserves, but because of a promise that David had made to Jonathan, and he's keeping it. And in that way, a lame person is being brought to that city where David said that all of the blind and lame were hated. Okay, chapter 10. Now it happened afterward that the king of the Ammonites died, and Hanun his son became king in his place. Then David said, I will show kindness to Hanun, the son of Nahash, just as his father showed kindness to me. So David sent some of his servants to console him concerning his father. But when David's servants came to the land of the Ammonites, the prince of the Ammonites said to Hanun, their lord, do you think that David is honoring your father because he has sent consolers to you? Has David not sent his servants to you in order to search the city, to spy it out and overthrow it? So Hanun took David's servants and shaved off half of their beards and cut off their garments in the middle as far as their hips and sent them away. When they told it to David, he sent to meet them, for the men were greatly humiliated. And the king said, stay at Jericho until your beards grow and then return. Okay, the Ammonites live just to the northeast of Jerusalem. It's in the Transjordan area, not too far north of where Jerusalem is. Israel has had conflict with the Ammonites over a long period of time. And in fact, the king that's mentioned here, Nahash, was the king of the Ammonites very early in Saul's reign, when Saul had just become king. And the Israelites went to battle against the Ammonites and defeated them, and that was a battle in which they were aided by God and allowed to defeat them very early on when Saul had just become king. Apparently then, Nahash was subdued at that point in time, and the relationship between the Israelites and the Ammonites must have improved. There must have been a friendly relationship between David and Nahash. Nahash subservient to David, but nevertheless recognized as a king of the Ammonites. So when he dies, David wants to console his heir, Hanun, and I suspect he wants to establish a good relationship between David and the heir to the throne, Hanun. So he sends emissaries to the Ammonites in order to extend this offer, I can only assume, that David is making to the heir. They are not greeted in the spirit in which they're sent. Hanun's princes, the ones who are advising him, are very suspicious of this move. They see these emissaries as spies. In all likelihood, as they see it, they have come to find out if there are any weak places in the walls of the city, see if there are any tunnels that water is conducted through or whatever, that they might be able to sneak into the city. In any case, they think that they're coming as spies. And Hanun, the young heir to the throne, the one who has just become king, is persuaded by this argument. He's convinced that, yes, indeed, they've come just to spy it out. So he decides that he will show David, he will show the king of Israel, that he will not be messed with. And he shows this by dishonoring the emissaries, the messengers that were sent. He cuts off half their beard. I would assume that he shaves half the face. I don't know, but I can see where that would be dishonoring. And cuts the garments at the hips. So apparently the lower half of the garments are just cut off, which is also dishonoring. So these emissaries are so embarrassed by the state that they're in that they don't want to come back to Jerusalem. And David understands it and says, well, why don't you hold out at Jericho until your beard grows back and we'll get you some new clothes. And then you can return to Jerusalem. So this is a huge insult that the Ammonites have given to the Israelites. Next section. Now when the sons of Ammon saw that they had become odious to David, the sons of Ammon sent and hired the Arameans of Beth-Rehob and the Arameans of Zobah, 20,000 foot soldiers, and the king of Maacah with 1,000 men, and the men of Tob with 12,000 men. When David heard of it, he sent Joab and all the army, the mighty men. And the sons of Ammon came out and drew up in battle array at the entrance of the city, while the Arameans of Zobah and of Rehob and the men of Tob and Maacah were by themselves in the field. It's not clear to me what Hanun expected. He had to have known that this would be offensive and that there would be some kind of response. It's possible that David's response was greater than Hanun had expected. It's also possible that it's exactly what Hanun had expected, but he's using this opportunity to form an alliance that takes in more than just the Ammonites. In any case, that's what the Ammonites do. They bring in, they hire Arameans to come in and fight as mercenary soldiers for the Ammonites. And it's quite a few men. It's 20,000 foot soldiers. That's a pretty big army for these times. In addition to another 1,000 men from Maacah and 12,000 men from Tob. So it's, what's that, a total of 33,000 men. That's a lot of mercenaries on top of what the army that the Ammonites can muster on their own. So this army is put together, and it's really divided into two parts. The Ammonites are as one force, and then these mercenary Arameans are another force. Verse 9. Now when Joab saw that the battle was set against him in front and in the rear, he selected from all the choice men of Israel and arrayed them against the Arameans. But the remainder of the people he placed in the hand of Abishai, his brother, and he arrayed them against the sons of Ammon. And he said, "If the Arameans are too strong for me, then you shall help me. But if the sons of Ammon are too strong for you, then I will come to help you. Be strong, and let us show ourselves courageous for the sake of our people and for the cities of our God. And may the Lord do what is good in his sight." So Joab and the people who were with him drew near to the battle against the Arameans, and they fled before them. When the sons of Ammon saw that the Arameans fled, they also fled before Abishai and entered the city. Then Joab returned from fighting against the sons of Ammon and came to Jerusalem. It's relatively rare in the Old Testament that we have details of a battle, a strategy, and where how armies are arrayed. We do have this here a little bit, and it suggests that what is being emphasized here is Joab's competence as a military commander. Apparently, the Israelite forces are trapped between these two opposing forces. The Ammonites are in front of them. The Arameans are behind them. What Joab decides to do is to divide the Israelite army into two parts. One part will be made up of the best soldiers. And that group of the best soldiers, they are going to take on the Arameans. The rest of the army is going to fight against the Ammonites. But there is this agreement. They're both going to be seeing how well they do against the army that is opposite them. And whichever of the Israelite armies has the most difficult time, the other will come to its aid. As it turns out, Joab is able to, and his army is able to drive the Arameans away. And then both armies, Israelite armies, are able to reunite and attack the Ammonites and go into the city as well. So they are thoroughly victorious in this conflict with the Ammonites. Last section. When the Arameans saw that they had been defeated by Israel, they gathered themselves together. And Hadadezer sent and brought out the Arameans who were beyond the river. And they came to Helam. And Shobach, the commander of the army of Hadadezer, led them. Now when it was told David, he gathered all Israel together and crossed the Jordan and came to Helam. And the Arameans arrayed themselves to meet David and fought against him. But the Arameans fled before Israel. And David killed 700 charioteers of the Arameans and 40,000 horsemen and struck down Shobach, the commander of their army, and he died there. When all the kings, servants of Hadadezer, saw that they were defeated by Israel, they made peace with Israel and served him. So the Arameans feared to help the sons of Ammon anymore. So after the defeat of the Ammonites, the Arameans are concerned about this growing strength of the Israelites. The Israelites are really on a roll and have been for some time. And the defeat of the Ammonites just highlights that fact. So the Arameans decide, we've got to do something. We've got to stand up against them and make sure that they aren't a threat with respect to us. So the Arameans decide to appeal to their kinsmen far and wide. They even appeal to their kinsmen on the other side of the river. That's the Euphrates River. That's deep into Syria that they are recruiting soldiers from in order to go against the Israelites. So this is a large army of Arameans gathered from the entire area, brought to fight against the army of Israel. David finds out that there is this huge force that has been arrayed against them. And so David gathers an army from all of Israel in order to go and fight against the Arameans. This time, David is there commanding. Joab had commanded in the war that had just occurred. Now David shows up and leads the forces against the Arameans. And it is once again a great victory for the Israelites. A huge number of our Arameans are struck down. It says 40,000 horsemen, 700 charioteers. So it's a huge victory for the Israelites. And in addition to that, the commander of the Aramean army is put to death, Shobach. So it's a huge victory for the Israelites. And from now on, the Arameans are in subjection to the Israelites, at least for a period of time. So at this point in the narrative, David has established Israel as a regional power. He has extended the boundaries of Israel so that now it controls all of Palestine, whereas under Saul, it didn't even control all of Palestine. The Philistine areas were out of Israel's control. Now all of those areas have been brought into control. And pockets of Canaanites that had been throughout Israel, such as the Jebusites in Jerusalem, all of those have been conquered and brought under Israelite control. But not just in Palestine proper. The Israelites have extended their control to the Transjordan. All along the Transjordan, that the habitable area just on the other side has been brought under Israelite control. And in addition to that, David has been able to extend Israelite control to the northeast as far as the river, as far as the Euphrates River, which is interesting, which is in fulfillment of the prophecy that God had made to Abraham, that the boundaries of Israel would extend to the river, to the Euphrates. So David has been hugely successful in expanding the boundaries of Israel and gaining control of all of that area. We seem to be at the midpoint of David's life here. Up to now, everything that David has done has turned out well. God has clearly been working behind the scenes to make David successful. He had his difficulties with Saul. He had his conflict with Saul. He had to flee and was in hiding for a number of years. But the narrative makes it really clear that God was looking out for David and God was helping David be successful in the things that he was doing. And we have seen David as a very noble person with high ideals. He's been faithful. He's been faithful to God. He's been loyal to the king. He's been loyal to Saul all the time that Saul was alive. And he's been successful in virtually everything that he has attempted to do. But we're going to see now that David's life kind of takes a turn, at least as far as the narrative is concerned. From here on out, what we're going to see is, well, in the next chapter, he commits adultery with Bathsheba, and he murders. And then from then on, what we're going to see is David's hardships as king. There are going to be three attempted coups two by his sons. There's going to be a plague. There's virtually everything that happens from here on out is a trial for David. And we no longer see him as entirely noble. We see him as a sinner. We see him struggling with futility, with turmoil in his family and in the nation. We see him struggling with betrayal of people against his rule and his power. I think it's interesting that the picture that we see of David is he lived a hard life. He was uniquely blessed by God in some respects. He was given a great blessing in chapter 7. And we have seen God's hand in his life and dealing with him, and God has shaped him into a remarkable human being. And God says that David is one in whom he is well pleased. But he lived a hard life, and the narrative wants to make that clear, and we will see that as we progress. Surely there are other things that happened in his life from here on out. The author has been selective, and I'm sure there were many good things that happened from here on out. But the author wants to paint a different picture. The author wants to highlight the futility that David encounters, the difficulties that he encounters. Some of that, we will see, is the result of his sin, I think. That David sins, and he sins grievously. He is repentant for what he does. God forgives him. But nevertheless, he's going to suffer some of the consequences of what he had done. And that is something that God allows to happen and probably allows to happen very graciously. So I think it is true that some of what happens from here on out would not have happened had it not been for the sins that he committed. But I don't think that the hardness of his life can only be attributed to the sin, because in the first part of his life he had hardship as well, and there we don't have the same kind of attribution of those difficulties to sins that he had committed. Never before when I've read through this narrative did it strike me, to the extent that it is this time, how difficult David's life was. He is not uniquely privileged in the sense that he got a life that was free of trials. Even the very blessed live a difficult life. And I think that we're to understand that it has to be so. Life was made to be hard. Life is a training ground for our souls. Life is a set of experiences in which God works on that part of us that's eternal to bring it into conformity with his values. I think it is striking that in Hebrews, in a verse that I mentioned last week and said that I don't understand it, and I still don't, but it is interesting that it says with respect to Jesus that he learned obedience through suffering. That even the perfect learned obedience through suffering. That our souls are being shaped by our experiences, by what God takes us through. We all need to learn constantly and in a variety of different circumstances and difficulties what it means to say truly, not my will but thine be done. That's what Jesus had to learn. That's what we all have to learn. And this is something that is of eternal benefit. Our souls are being shaped. Our souls are being crafted. They're being made into something beautiful. They're being made into something that truly thirsts after righteousness and will indeed be righteous one day. I mention all of this because I've had several conversations over the last week, people expressing their concerns with respect to our economic situation. I don't know what's going to happen in the next few months or even years. I don't know what's going to happen. It does, as the video, I stand by what I said in the video. It does look a bit ominous to me. And I think we have only seen the tip of the iceberg. I think even if the stock market goes up 1,000 points on Monday, I still think that the ramifications of what has already happened in the economy are going to play themselves out, and it's going to get dicey. And every one of us will be affected differently. We've each got our own set of trials that we are going to have to deal with, and each set is going to be different. Each set is uniquely customized for us by God. And our challenge will be to respond to this wisely and obediently, to respond as God would want us to respond, and that will be a challenge. But what's coming is a set of challenges that is designed by a good and loving God to do his work in our souls to make us the people that he intended us to be, to build righteousness into us, to make us the kind of people that love that which is good and righteous. And for that challenge, we're going to need faith that God is who he says he is, wisdom to know what to do in each particular set of circumstances, and strength from God to do that which is the right thing to do. So our challenge will be to be obedient no matter what we face. And I suspect that will be a challenge. But it is of eternal benefit in the end. It's all the activity of a loving God who's doing wonderful things in our souls. Okay, little time for questions or comments.
I couldn't help but notice the similarities between the struggles that I have in life and how the scriptures kind of illustrate David's struggle. Not that I'm king or anything. Yeah. And there seems to be two tenses in which we struggle. We struggle to have, or we struggle because we want, and then we struggle when we have. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I see David's struggle as, well, gee, God has promised me this, and there's this struggle to get this that God has promised me. And there's kind of nobility that we attach to that struggle, where it's like, well, David had all this faith, and he was, you know, trying to do the right thing, and he was patient, etc. And then there's the struggle of him actually having the kingdom and not recognizing that he had it. I mean, not being content in that he had it. Taking another man's wife, etc., where, you know, God says, hey, listen, you had all this, and yet you still wanted more. And I just see my life that way, in that there are two tenses in which I struggle and sin before God. I tell myself that, well, if I have this, then I'll be happy. If I have this, then I'll be fulfilled. And so I strive to get this, and then I have it, and of course I'm not fulfilled, and I say, I'm ungrateful for it, and I don't recognize that God has blessed me with the things that I have strived towards. And I guess, bottom line, there's, as you said, this world is filled with struggle, and it's that process of both of those tenses, it seems like, that helps us come to terms with our need for mercy, because no matter which tense we're in, we still don't trust God.
Yeah. That's, it is so hard for us to truly understand that everything we have is a gift from God. That, and I think what we'll see with David is he came to take for granted what he had. And lost sight of the fact that this was a gift from God and started thinking of it in terms of something that he inherently deserved. And we all struggle with that in one way or another. And it's a huge struggle.
I have a kind of a blank spot in my knowledge of geography here, mm-hmm. and political geography. So I have two questions. One is, you'd mentioned the Benjamite territory. So mm-hmm. were the clans of Israel just parsed out according to like lands in Israel? Or, I mean, did particular clans live primarily in particular areas? Is that how that worked? Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So I have one more question, so don't spend yourself all on that one.
Well, give me 30 seconds on
okay,
this one,
good,
and
good.
Then I'll save the rest for later.
Okay.
When they enter into the promised land, I think Moses, I can't remember whether it was Moses or Joshua, he announces to the people of Israel which areas are given to which tribe. And each tribe is given a certain area, and their job then is to defeat the Canaanites that live in that area and possess that area.
Okay. And so would it have been unseemly to kind of live in another area if you were a Benjamite or something like that? That isn't my second question, by the way.
Was it unseemly? It happened.
Okay.
You have instances where people will live outside of their ancestral area, but it's relatively rare, except for the Levites. Levites aren't given land, so they live throughout. But it would be relatively rare for people to live outside of their tribal area.
So when they conquer the Syrians, or the Syrians are subjected to Israel, that which extends, if I'm making sense of my map correctly, extends the empire to the Euphrates,
mm-hmm.
Do they become Jews?
No.
Okay, so...
They are just a subject territory to the Israelites.
Okay, so it's part of David's empire, but they don't necessarily go live in this part
no.
of the land. So.
He does establish, I think we've already seen it, either that or it comes up later, he does establish a military presence in the Transjordan area, but I don't think that we're to see that as a permanent Israelite presence in those areas.
So, and is there a technical term between like parts of empires that the people actually inhabit and parts that are still part of the empire but they don't inhabit? Like, is there a term for that? Like,
the empire is that. David's empire is all of that territory which is subject to him. But not all of that is Israelite. So the kingdom proper would just be that area which is inhabited by the Israelites. So it's primarily Palestine with a little bit of Israeli settlement in the Transjordan, but not very much.
Then I'm done with this one. So the particular tribal lands never really extend. Like the, I mean,
they don't
sorry,
get bigger.
They don't get bigger, right?
They don't get bigger. They change a little bit. There are some adjustments that get made, but they don't change much.
That's interesting.
This is more of a comment on your general wrap-up than any particular geographical or historical element here. It really struck me, I'm reading from my note here, you said about 10 minutes ago, quote, "It is so hard to understand, for all of us to understand that everything that happens to us is a gift from God." And about a minute after that, or before that, you also mentioned that the economic difficulty is likely to be bringing about a lot of major adjustments and trials. And I've been thinking about that quite a bit for like the last 2 months. I wonder what it is that God is intending in this coming possible crash in reference to local church fellowships and taking care of one another, including specifically in this body. I've been praying about the need for possibly establishing local neighborhood care groups in this body and maybe even working with other Christians and non-believers on a neighborhood basis, and was kind of curious if there's been any thought given to that.
I haven't given thought to it. I haven't given thought to anything about organizing a response. But it is in these kinds of situations where there is a major change in our environment, and that's part of what's happening here. Our economic environment is changing drastically, and that means a change in our daily activities, etc. When you have that kind of major change, it is a time to kind of take stock of what's important and what's not important, and how can we best achieve that which is most important. And so it is a time for an opportunity for a lot of personal change. And we can look at our situation kind of with fresh eyes. I think about it as an opportunity to think the unthinkable. Look at our situation with fresh eyes, and are there things that we have been overlooking, things that should be changed that we've been overlooking for a long time, and now's the time to do something about it? And that's a great opportunity. That's a good thing to do. And I don't know how this is going to play out. I don't know what kinds of needs are going to manifest themselves. But we should think creatively about how we can meet those needs, which are true needs, in a way that is consistent with God's principles. How can we best do that? And that's a good thing for all of us. Okay, thanks.